All of the views and opinions expressed here are those of the individual speaking and may not be representative of Coding American. At times, language may be considered vulgar. Listener discretion is suggested.
You are now listening to the Coding Behind the Wheel podcast.
All right, we're live. Travis Reeder, Formula Drift Pro 2 driver. Are you ready for a 10-question quickfire?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
I'm in.
Missile car or competition car?
Competition car.
Favorite car in FD that's not your own?
Favorite car in FD that's not my own? Oh my gosh. Fields Corvette.
Favorite person to tandem with?
Dylan Hughes.
Park or Evergreen?
Ooh, Park.
If you couldn't drift, what other motorsport do you think you would do?
What motorsport would I want to do?
Sure, anything.
Stadium Super Trucks.
Ooh, that's different. I wasn't expecting that. Gone in 60 Seconds or Fast and the Furious?
Fast and Furious.
Your absolute favorite track, period?
Oregon Raceway Park.
S13 or S14?
S13.
What celebrity do you think you'd most like to teach how to drift?
Oh, wow. That's an extremely difficult question to answer.
Yeah, fair enough.
Zach Galifianakis.
Okay. All right.
I like that.
So you're from Seattle. Starbucks or small indie coffee shops?
I actually don't drink coffee at all.
Fair enough. I don't either. So we'll just leave that as it is. All right. So we have made it through the slowest 10-question quickfire that we've done so far. That's pretty good.
Yep. I was expecting that.
Well, yeah. That's how we keep it on your toes around here. I'm Scott. I'm the marketing director for Koenig Wheels. With me is Joey Redmond. Joey's the founder of Wrecked Magazine and has been published in over 20 automotive magazines. Additionally, has built SEMA vehicles for OEs like Hyundai and Ford. Finally, you can find his 10 Things Learned article available on formuladrift.com after each FD event. And with us today is Travis Reeder. Travis hails from Vancouver, Washington, in the Pacific Northwest, and is in his second season of FD Pro 2. Last year, Travis was Formula Drift Pro 2 Rookie of the Year and missed the championship by only 2 points. Travis, thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, dude, no problem.
I think there's so much that we can talk about. When I was actually sitting down to try to put some thoughts together, I think the toughest part I had was trying to figure out questions that I wanted to ask you or things that we wanted to talk about that wouldn't occupy hours and hours. Because,
yeah.
I mean, I have the intimate knowledge of having a little bit more of behind the curtain. So there's so many things that I think would be good for other people. Your program has like an overall really good message behind it. I don't even know that you know necessarily what I mean by the message, but a lot of what your program came to mean to me when I had the overall big view was how prepared you are and how it's important for really to strip down the pieces of the program that are not important. For example, to keep your program as efficient as possible, you took a lot of the BS out to keep things reliable, whether it be the car and getting seat time and not changing setups all over the place. And I think that that's really important for people, whether they're starting out or they're still running some of the bigger programs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from my perspective, I get to see teams go into Pro 2 at all different skill levels and all different funding levels. And your program, I don't think that I've ever seen anybody come into Pro 2 and had as successful of a run their first season with as small of a program as you have. So I think that, I mean, that's a compliment. I'll just throw that in.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah.
That
wasn't easy.
Yeah. Oh, I know. What's your program like to run?
So we're super low budgeted as far as like compared to other teams.
Right.
So, I don't have like a really wealthy background, no really financial backing. Mainly everything's out of my pocket or help from family, really, who doesn't really have a lot to begin with.
Right.
So a big thing with my program is having reliability and simplicity, which if you do that correct, then you save on cost.
Sure.
So we have like, I don't spend money for hotel rooms or anything like that because people who have seen me at FD events, a lot of them have met my grandparents. They always have the RV there.
Right.
So me and the whole team crashed in the RV with grandma and grandpa, and they just stock the RV full of food. And grandma makes meals for us. which is super awesome. So we really don't have to spend a lot on like rental cars, Uber rides, hotels, eating out, just things that a lot of teams kind of have to when the team's huge and you have like, say, a race rig that you can't accommodate a whole team in.
Right.
So that really helps out a lot. That's pretty much cuts down the biggest expense as far as like travel and expenses of like feeding a crew and like taking care of them. We kind of have like the whole package worked out in our little pit area, which is cool. It's really efficient that way and it works really well. On top of that, the car's just super basic. It's just naturally aspirated V8 with maybe a little bit of nitrous and super generic off-the-shelf parts. It's nothing crazy, nothing really changing the game. We're not trying to do anything different. The car is just pretty much set up exactly how I've driven it for the past 7 years, other than just like adding horsepower and adding parts to make it as reliable as I can.
Yeah. What do the people look like before you get to the event? How many people do you have to prep the car? How many people do you have, you know, to help you prep the car? How many people do you have to help move the car around the country? How many people do you have on race day, you know, and event weekends?
So here at home, I have me, Gramps, and a couple friends that kind of like shuffle in and out when I ask for help. I have a pretty awesome group of friends that if I'm ever in crunch time with the car and need help, a lot of them like to come over and jam and help me get everything done. But for the most part, it's me, Grandpa, and a select few of my homies that have had hands on the car since I started Pro-Am a few years ago. So that right. pretty much stays pretty tight knit, other than like tuners and like kind of outside people like that. But and then as far as transportation, the last couple years, my grandparents have been just trucking the car across the country behind the RV because they love to travel. So that helps me in a sense that I can kind of stay home and get a paycheck and then fly out and meet up with them to kind of keep the bank account afloat.
It's crazy.
And then once I get to the track, last year, I had no legitimate crew at all. I kind of shared crew members with a friend of mine, Cameron Moore.
Right.
He's about 20 minutes up the road from me. So his crew actually, they stepped in and helped me and pulled double duty. And his two crew members, Chuck and Chase, helped me during Pro 2 times and then helped Cameron during Pro 1 times. So they busted ass and did super awesome with that. But I didn't want to put that on them again. That was kind of like we were a little unprepared last year coming in because we didn't really know what to expect. But and that night, I refused to get Gramps a hard card because he thinks that him at 77 can go out on the hot grid and jam, which I don't doubt that he can, but he shouldn't have that weight on his shoulders after everything else that he does. So
yeah, man, that's
yes,
that's incredible. Joey, you know a lot of people and a lot of drivers. Do you know of anybody that may operate that in a similar capacity?
I mean, probably there's nobody that operates at that capacity that's successful.
I mean, it's just incredible. Like when I watched Travis come in last year, and it's interesting, and I want you to tell the story from your point of view about how we linked up at some point. I told it actually the podcast with Caleb Kwanback. I think we did that in episode 2. We kind of told the story a little bit, but you're the other piece of the puzzle. So it'd be cool to hear from your perspective. But when we linked up with Travis, that was one of the things I think I appreciated the most was there's so many people that sell a program before they actually can run a program or are successful in actually with like, you know, if their skill set's refined enough to be competitive, they sell this big program, they come after you, they want all these things. And Travis was just getting it done. And I thought that was incredibly impressive.
I was winging it. Well, last year.
You wung well.
Yeah, so do you want to get into the backstory of how that came about?
Yeah, we can. That's cool.
Yeah, it was so like going into Orlando last year, it was me, Gramps, and Grandma. We drove across the country from Portland to Orlando. Actually took the time off work to drive with them because it was a pretty far jaunt and I didn't want Gramps having to drive by himself the whole time.
Crazy.
So we ventured across and kind of didn't know what to expect. Showed up at the track and Cameron was like, "All right, we got your crew set up. You're ready to go. You're pitting with us." And I was like, "What? All right, cool. Well, this is gonna work then," because we were kind of blind at that point.
Right.
Yeah. So long story short, going into battles, Orlando's a very unforgiving track, and I ended up. I think it was a kind of a mix of shock stroke mixed with wheel width mixed with tire width and air pressure changes that we kept blowing tires off the wheel repeatedly, and ended up breaking like 4 of my own wheels when I only had brought 8 rears for the weekend, because that's all I had and all I could afford. So we were kind of stressing out about that. And me knowing Caleb, who used to live in Portland, we used to go drifting all the time together a long time ago, like 2010, 2011. He was like, yo, I have all my Koenigs at my buddy's shop. If you want to borrow some, it's just kind of you break them, you buy them. And I'm like, yo, I need wheels, so I don't care.
Right.
I was like, I got you. And then he's like, Caleb's like, you know what, you should hit up Scott. He's like a super cool guy. And we ended up going to that shop and picking up wheels. And I kind of like took a goofy picture with him and tagged you in it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is never going to work, you know. Right. This guy's just going to be like, look at this clown barring wheels. Like, I don't even know him. And then, so I ended up going through the event on Caleb's wheels and my wheels mixed and matched. And it was like pretty hilarious how well it worked, actually. And then I ended up debeating in the final 4 against Brody Goble.
Right.
Yeah. And then I ran half the lap against Brody on the single wheel. And a lot of people, I'm sure, have seen that if they follow Pro 2. I ended up winning the battle, which was crazy. But yeah, I blew up Caleb's wheel. He texted me and he just like sent me dollar signs. It was like super hilarious.
Yeah.
So then we linked up like over kind of through email and that next week after I'd like kind of decided to, I don't know, super
well,
weird.
Cause you had what happened only like, what, it was a week and a half or two or 12 or 13 days later was Orlando to Atlanta.
Yeah. So.
You were making the climb up to Atlanta, and I think you had said to me, when I reached out to you, we kind of made contact, and I was like, oh, well, let me see what I can do, and you're like, yeah, whatever you can do, anything that I can do before Atlanta, because I don't have any more wheels.
Yeah, I was super stuck.
And then when we figured it out, we were like, oh, we'd only have about 6 or 7 days to make this thing happen and get wheels out. So I think I ended up, before we even did the contract, I'm like, look, let me get wheels out now, because we sent them right from our warehouse right to the track. We went right to Road Atlanta.
Yeah, yeah, they're waiting at Road Atlanta. We'll call.
Right. So so we sent those wheels out just to get them out, and I think we did the contract when you were back home a few weeks later, just because it was like, we had to make a choice.
Yeah.
What were we going to do here? So, man, that was tight.
Yeah, because it was 5 days before Atlanta, and as of like that point, I only had 6 wheels total, including my fronts that weren't broken.
Right. Yeah.
I was stressing a little bit.
Yeah. That was probably the only time that you really had that major issue from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think you work at Nameless Performance? Give everybody, I mean, I could give them a summary of what Nameless Performance is, but you'd probably do a much better job than I would.
Yeah, so Nameless Performance is just kind of a small exhaust business grown into a bigger exhaust business in a very short time. It's John and Jason. We build exhaust systems for Subarus. They're really big into rally, and they're local in my area. Our shop's in Woodland, Washington, and I TIG weld for them and build exhaust systems. It's all stainless, kind of our like modular exhaust systems, from downpipes, cat-backs, like full cats. Just weird stuff that we do, mainly just for all sorts of different kinds of Subarus. But
you guys do a lot of,
yeah, it's really...
there's been some fab work that's happened, especially they've been a part of some of the bigger drift programs, right? They have Turk's program and.
Yeah. So they brought on Turk in, don't quote me, I didn't work there at the time, but I think it was 2015.
Okay.
I think was his first year, 2014 or 2015, maybe. Turk was at PSI, I believe, the year before, and then came to Nameless. And then they ran his program for 2 or 3 years, I believe. And then Chris came on the last year, Chris Forsberg.
Right.
So they kind of doubled up and ran Chris Forsberg and Ryan Turk's teams out of there, as well as building Cameron Moore a new chassis during that season prep. So that was a pretty crazy off season the year they did that. I think it was 2017. Yeah, 2016 going into 2017 was like crazy hectic off season. The guys were jamming out cars left and right in the shop, killing it. But I really don't see that side as much, as far as I'm a production welder, so I'm on the other side of the business.
Okay.
But obviously I hang out with those guys more than most because of my involvement, and we chat after work, but I don't have any physical hand in like building the cars.
Sure. Do you think that some of the exposure you've had from those guys maybe indirectly has been one of the keyholes in the reliability that you've learned to maintain, like in your car and your builds and stuff like that? Or you think that was completely coincidental?
No, I mean, like having bosses that are really into motorsports and have experience in professional motorsports,
right,
whether it be drifting or rally or anything else that those guys are into, it's always nice because we can learn from each other in different aspects of a program, because they've done things I haven't done and I've done things they haven't done. So it's nice to be able to feed and gain knowledge from each other. But my car had always been pretty reliable in Pro-Am. I just did learn some tips and tricks from those guys as far as setting up cars once I got closer and more hands-on with being able to see Ryan and Chris's vehicles up close and right. Seeing kind of how they operated. And so that did help. Yeah, I think it was kind of a joint effort. It was already pretty reliable from the get-go. I just was able to make it more reliable with help of like good people that surrounded me.
Taking it back a little bit, where was your first exposure to drifting?
Just kind of normal, like on the internet.
Really?
I had my whole family's been into cars, NASCAR, drag racing, things like that. So I kind of grew up around like hot rods and different things. And, multiple members of my family have been known to do a burnout or two. So that's kind of like, I was already screwed as far as getting into cars. Once I got older and was able to drive, I was already headed down this road, whether I liked it or not. So, I had my first car was a 1990 Toyota pickup, just like single cab, short bed, two wheel drive. My dad gave it to me. It was an old work truck. And, I ended up like welding the diff and doing a bunch of stuff behind his back that he hates that I did. But that's the first kind of vehicle I tried drifting in and broke it. And like did all sorts of stuff that pissed him off. And then, ended up getting a 240 like 4 or 5 years later. This was back in high school when I had the truck. So I was like 15, 16.
Right.
And then kind of started like, you know, finding abandoned parking lots, warehouses, things like that, that everyone doesn't say that they do, but they all do it.
You mean in Mexico?
Yes. Mexico, south of the border. Yeah. And then after a few years of that, I bought my first 240, which is actually my Pro 2 car right now. The first 240 I ever bought when I was 17.
Same chassis.
Mm-hmm. Same exact chassis. I bought it with money I was supposed to go to college with instead of going to college.
Yeah,
I bought a 240, and then, good life decisions.
What did the car look like when you first started?
It was like bone stock, like off the showroom floor, 120,000 miles, single cam car, all the factory options. Paid like $1,200 for it, which was like high at the time. This was like 2010.
Right.
I just bought it from some dude in Portland and drove it home, and then, it was just all white. Had the factory like crappy brown interior. Just factory SEs, had a pig nose lip on it, and like other than that, it was like completely stock suspension, stock everything. So
do you remember what your first mods were like when you first started to get into drifting, like when you were actually starting to, you know, use it in some form? Do you remember what progression of mods you started with?
Yeah, I know exactly what I did in the exact order. It took I bought the car, and it took about a week before I welded the diff, and then bought a set of coilovers from a buddy, just a used set of coilovers, and then did the little like tie rod spacers to like get a little more travel out of the rack, but still with a factory knuckle. And then that was pretty much it for like 2 years. That's all I did. I drove it like that with just welded diff, coilovers, and the steering spacers.
How long did it take you to go from where you were to where your car is now, years-wise? I know you didn't try to build it from there to from that point to that point, but how many years are we talking about, just so people get an idea?
It was, I'll break down like the stages of the car, I guess.
Sure.
2010 to 2012 was just basically factory single cam, coilovers, welded diff, and I drove just like Pat's Acres events and Mexico events,
right,
and things. And so that was like a 2 year thing. And then my buddy, I ended up getting an RB20 motor set from a friend whose car was stolen and cut up, and they found all of the parts.
Wow.
He had got insurance money and kind of got compensated for it. But they found the motor and transmission and a bunch of his parts in this guy's house that they raided.
That's a so bad we got a bunch day of for that dude, you know?
Yeah.
That dude is like, no, I didn't do it.
Yeah, and everything's just sitting in his living room. Yeah. So my buddy had already obviously scrapped the car, so we didn't need the parts. So I got a motor and tranny. At that time, like anything but a single cam was cool, so I bought it. And ran a RB20 out for like 2 years, basically exactly the same setup. I had had like, I put an eBay like bucket seat in it, and I had hydraulic handbrake and cut and welded my own knuckles. So that was like 2012 to 2014. And then after that, I had ran a bunch of local events, just Park, PIR, Medford, hadn't gone up to Evergreen yet, but drove those enough to where I wanted to kind of progress. And Gramps was just getting out of aviation, so he wasn't really flying anymore. And he was like, let's build something, because that's, he like, if his hands aren't moving, he's freaking out. He's having a panic attack. He like has to be building something all the time.
I love that.
Yeah, he's the best. So he's like, let's build your car. Let's put a V8 in it. And I'm like, you're crazy. That's stupid. Like, turbo motors. Let's stay Japanese with it.
He's ahead, like, of his time.
Oh, yeah. Dude, he's insane. He still teaches me things that I, like, have no idea how he knows certain things. It's just, it's nuts. That dude's, his knowledge in every form of life really is crazy. Yeah, so he's like, let's put a V8 in it. And I'm like, I can't afford that crap. So I, like, saved up forever, bought, like, a 5.3 iron block LS motor. My buddy wrecked a Camaro. I bought a T56 out of it. Kind of threw it together over a whole year of not driving and got a 5.3 in the car. And that's, I drove for a year with a V8. It was like 300 horsepower. Still drove the same local events with it. That was all through 2014 to 2015. Blew up a couple motors from my own personal mistakes. We were like learning on how to build a car and put together like a reliable V8, because not many people local had them at the time.
Yeah.
So finally got together, and then, yeah, 2016 to now has all been like higher, kind of higher build V8s, which was from 2015 to, yeah, 2018, between like Pro-Am to Pro-2 to Pro-2 again.
That's crazy.
If you could go back, would you change your motor like progression at all? Like, do you think how you did your motors like hindered or helped you at all into like your progress in a Pro-2?
So I've always had a car that's been underpowered as far as like whatever series I'm in or like group of friends or whatever. So I drove my single cam basically until I couldn't drive it any better. I drove that car at 120% all the time, to where that car did things that it shouldn't have been able to do. And that's when I knew that I could change motors and go to more power, because I wanted to stay as low powered as possible to learn like vehicle characteristics and how to like use weight instead of power and use line and like holding speed and just learning that aspect. And I think that is what kind of shaped me as a driver, staying underpowered for so long and really learning how a car reacts to every input when you don't have horsepower to band-aid it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Joey and I have this conversation. I think we've done this a couple times now about that line between power and how, but we just talked about this last time, how horsepower can kind of give you some extra room and make up for some things that the car may be deficient on in other places.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's crazy. But it's such a good lesson too for people that are coming up and trying to build cars. And they, you know, I think so many people have a tendency to get, you know, that acquisition syndrome where they're trying to, you know, just put parts in the car and they overbuild these cars and they don't really have a good understanding, a good feel for what they're doing. And it seems like your ability to do that and the length of time that you've had in that one platform seems to really have pushed you along, you know, when you got into a more competitive stage.
Yeah. So that definitely helps too, that I've been driving the car for, this is its eighth year in that chassis. Eighth year, and it's the only really car I've ever driven that, as far as like a consistent platform. A lot of people change around and change cars, but I never really had the option, because I never really, if I wanted to change chassis, I could never really afford it. So
right.
Luckily I had an S13, and you know, its background and its aftermarket support and everything's pretty much been done before me. So the good old Google machine helped me a lot. Yeah. So just being basically in the same driver's seat for seven going into 8 years definitely makes me really comfortable and really trust myself and trust the car. So
Joey and I have had this conversation. Joey, you know, when we talk about the difference between Pro-Am, Pro-2, Pro, and the different levels and things like that, what is it for people that are trying to, let's say, prepare They're preparing to go into Pro-Am now. Can you give them any advice for success? You know, things like, what is a solid vehicle for them at that stage, you know, preparing to go into Pro-Am look like? What kind of skill sets should they have or be working toward? What kind of prep tips should they be really focused on before they, you know, before they show up in an event?
Yeah, so I mean, I wasn't even planning on going into Pro-Am for 2016 until my grandpa kind of pushed me into it, because I'd never really done any competitive drifting, but I'd been driving probably an event a month for 6 years straight in that car at that point. So Gramps watches, you know, he goes, him and my grandma have gone to every single event, every single competition or serious event that I've been to for the last 4 or 5 years now. So he's like, we're just going to go up to Seattle and do Pro-Am and you're just going to do it. And I'm like, all right, whatever. This sounds fun. And, but at that point, like me and my friends had been driving park and like other events for so long to where we could like go through park pretty much blindfolded and door each other up and just learn. I learned how to drive with my friends so closely and we pushed each other so quick that I already had an ability to drive with other people before I came into Pro-Am. So like a skill set that's definitely needed is like tandeming is the biggest thing. People can link a course and put down like a gangster qualifying run or whatever and just be consistent by themselves. But new people coming into competition itself really get shaken up by tandem because it's so much more to think about and to like bring to the table. So many different things are happening at once. You have to basically focus on this moving clipping point and like throw everything else you focus on while you drive out the window,
right?
And focus on something completely different and then make split decision changes like on the fly, like so quick. You have to be super attentive. It's just so different. And a lot of people aren't prepared for that. They kind of like just like want to jump into Pro-Am, but they don't have the experience before,
right?
Like the experience they need to be competitive. And I'm not like knocking anybody for like wanting to jump into competition. Like it's cool. And I love competitive drifting. But like there are guys that jump into Pro-Am really early and end up staying in Pro-Am for a few years to learn through Pro-Am. But for me, I couldn't do that because I couldn't afford to do that. You know, some people can. And they can like spend the money for competitive drifting and like learn through Pro-Am. But I pretty much just learned with my friends in the cheapest cars possible because that's all we had at the time. So
Pro-Am level cars, what do you think people need to have and then they shouldn't have?
Pro-Am and Evergreen is kind of crazy. There's everything from like mild SR builds, 300 wheel SRs in Pro-Am, all the way up to like 800 wheel JZ cars. And then one guy like during our Pro-Am year brought out like a Mustang, like an S197, like two body styles ago.
Yeah, I don't know, like the 05 Mustang kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They brought out one of those with like a 2.5 liter Whipple Coyote motor in it. It was like nuts, like an X Formula D car from a long time ago that they had bought. So it's like you get everything from like really just like basic 300 horsepower 240s to like crazy competition builds. So like the field is really diverse in Pro-Am, and that's what it's like getting really difficult to like find a chassis that works to drive with both sides, you know?
Right. What do you think about that same thought going from Pro-Am to Pro 2? This is Joe. He made the jump. So he went, so 2016, he was Pro-Am. 2017, he was Pro 2. And you know, I mean, in theory, and we'll get there later, but in 2018, he could have been Pro. You did something that doesn't really happen. You went, like, in 1 year, you went from no experience from Pro-Am to Pro-Am to Pro 2. And then theoretically, you could have moved right on to Pro. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, so it was like I went into my card for Pro-Am was super simple, like it is today, just like at kind of a lower level. It was just a 6 liter iron block LS and a T56 stock diff, just did like Z33 axles, so I didn't keep breaking them. And then it was like 380 wheel on a good day,
right?
But it was just like it ran all the time once we like got the kinks worked out with like figuring out LS motors. But I just drove the crap out of it as much as I could. And I had it set up to where, see, Evergreen's also different because they run multiple track layouts that need different power levels. So they run like multiple events in the Pro-Am series are on the 3/8 bank, which is like the smaller course in the infield. And then they just run two events on the 5/8 bank, which is the big FD course. Like during like 3/8 events, you'd get a bunch more Pro-Am drivers because the cars didn't have to be as powerful. and you didn't have all the crazy like safety and cage requirements for the smaller track. So you'd have like a field of like 30 pro-am cars for a 3/8 round, but like barely make like a top eight sometimes for a 5/8 round because the cars had to be like a higher standard, you know?
Right.
So that was weird. But my car during pro-am was for 3/8 rounds, I just grip it up and like I threw like a big tire on the thing and made it to where I have like a habit of making my car grippier than horsepower. So my horsepower to grip level always gets to the point where I dial so much grip in to where I like struggle to spin the tires and I like back it down a notch. So it's like right on that verge of being happy. And that's how it was in pro-am, 380 wheel, and I still had a 275 on the car during 3/8 rounds.
Wow.
So it was like I'd like come off the bank and I'd just be super mean to it and just let the clutch go off the limiter and like third or fourth or whatever, and the thing would like barely like rev to like 5500, but the car would be fast.
Right.
So it would like never get to limiter, never like smoke the tires off. It was always super easy to drive because it was what I was used to, which is like underpowered with a lot of grip. And that's right. How my car is to like to this day in pro-am or in pro 2.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm like, so all these pro things.
Right. And then so then the car from the car essentially now in pro 2, the big difference from when you were competing in pro-am, what would you say the biggest changes that you made were to compete on pro 2?
Literally all we changed was, other than like small things to like fit in the FD rulebook, it was just engine transmission differential. So I just got a bigger motor, got a dog box so that I wouldn't blow up a T56 with the more power, and then got a quick change so I didn't blow up a factory rear end. So basically, like, we joke and call it the FD starter pack, which is LS motor, dog box, and a quick change. But it's super proven, and it works as long as you can, like, it is like a big cost up front, and I've been saving for a super long time, and I had some help also. That's another thing, is like when you have the money to spend on the car, don't necessarily just like throw it at the car for dumb stuff. I had been planning and like saving money for a long time and really only fixing on the car what I really needed to at that point, because I knew I wanted to keep progressing. So I wouldn't like blow money on just like dumb stuff that I didn't need. I always just only would spend money on something that would make the car that I either needed to make the car run or something that would make it more reliable or more drivable. So I'd been saving for a while for like the trans and the diff, and then ended up getting a motor package also.
Right. Last year, you went second in Orlando. You won at Atlanta.
Yeah.
You went sixth in Seattle. And then right after that point, you were leading the series, right?
Yeah.
And then you had some trouble against Meeks. You end up finishing 10th, right, some 10th in Seattle.
At Texas.
Oh, Texas, right.
Yeah.
In Texas. That must have been really hard. So you end up, and then you end up finishing 2 points behind Kevin Lawrence, who wins in Texas.
Yeah.
So that's got to be really tough. It's almost like you going into that last event. I mean, were you thinking about it? Were you saying like, I kind of got this in the bag, or?
No. So as weird as it sounds, I never really focused on points ever. Drifting is like, I try to, even during Pro 2, I still try to focus the majority of my energy and like concentration on the fact that I'm still drifting and I'm still having fun. At that point, I had already, going into Pro 2 in Orlando, my goal was just to qualify, you know, and just like a relatively competitive driver in the top 16, you know, and make it into the show. I ended up surpassing that, and I ended up getting a carbon fiber trophy, which was already insane for me. Like, I never thought I'd even be on the podium last year. And then to do it 2 times in a row, I was already on cloud 9 for the season. I didn't even care what happened the rest of the season. It was just already insane for me. And then by the end of Seattle going into Texas, kind of crunching the numbers, I was pretty much guaranteed rookie of the year. And that was already another thing that was insane to me, that is like even a possibility. So at that point, winning a championship would have been super cool, to come in like first year rookie of the year and a championship. But I'm not mad at all, because I still had a super stellar season, and like I basically like surpassed every goal I could have had last year, and it was just like an amazing experience in itself. So I'm not even like bothered by it.
Sure.
Okay, but I got a question. Like, so obviously you lost that in Texas, and then like, did you know that Kevin Lawrence basically had to win to beat you? And then if you did, like, what was it like watching those battles from the stands or wherever you were?
Yeah, so I didn't know that Kevin was even in contention. At that point, we were basically focusing on the top, like, or the three drivers below me that were still in the top 16. Kevin ended up being the fourth driver below me.
Right.
We kind of ruled him out because it kind of seemed like he was so far behind. But he obviously wasn't. He was just like right there. So I didn't even know until I got knocked down the top 16, and it was like final four battle when I was on the phone with a buddy of mine that was like, hey, you can't hear the live stream, but they just mentioned that Kevin's still in it. If he wins it, he can take it by 2 points. So I'm like, okay, like, that's crazy. I didn't even think about that. At that point, like, Van Kirk was behind me. He could have taken it, and he was out. He got knocked out by car issue. He had, like, a mechanical. And then the other person that could have taken the championship from me was... Damn, who's the other... Who is the third-place person?
Was it Josh Robinson? I think he was in third, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Robinson got knocked out. I believe that's what it was. So they were both out, and I was like, for like from top 16 to top 8, I was like, this is crazy. Like, I got it. Like, I can just like sit back and watch. And then they said that Kevin still could make it. So I was just sitting on the hot grid, like watching that jumbo, that massive TV, the big Haas or whatever in Texas. Just watching the battles. And Jared had actually on the live stream announced that I was the Pro 2 champion before the event was over, and congratulated my team and my grandparents and everything. So they didn't even take into consideration that it could have happened. It was like such a fluke. They didn't crunch numbers right, or like they hadn't even thought about considering it. So that was kind of crazy. And then he ended up winning. And I mean, the only thing I could do at that point was shake his hand, tell him good job. You know, I can't like be mad. It's motorsports. Obviously, like, it's a little, you know, it's a little saddening. Like, I was like kind of like frustrated, but that's like a natural reaction to that kind of thing, you know. But I wasn't like mad at him or mad at anything for it. It just, things like that happen in motorsports, and like, all I could do is like really focus on how good of a season it still was, you know?
Yeah, especially coming out of, especially your rookie season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had nothing to complain about other than maybe like my grandma got all excited that I won and then I didn't win. So that probably like took more of a toll on her than it did really anyone else. So I do feel bad that that happened to her. But other than that, like, I have like no complaints about last year. It was great.
That's crazy. So the podium is Kevin Lawrence is first. Mm-hmm. You were second. And yep. Matt Van Kirk was third.
Yeah.
First, Kevin Lawrence and Matt Van Kirk both made the decision to go up to pro. And mm-hmm. you made the decision to retain and remain in pro 2 for this season. What were your reasons behind that?
There's a lot of deciding factors in that. Obviously, now that I think about it, after thinking it over, at first I was like, yeah, I want to jump to pro. I want to keep progressing and keep driving with drivers that are way better than me. And that was like, for a couple months, that was like what I was pushing towards and trying to like figure out how to make it happen. And I'm glad that it didn't, because I'm starting to realize that experience is like worth its weight in gold. Like, you're not going to be able to jump in. And I'm not like bashing on guys that made the jump. Like, I couldn't do it, mainly like financially is like the biggest thing.
Sure.
It is a way bigger cost than Pro 2. Pro 2 is like penny pinching cheap compared to Pro 1. Right. And that's like, that's saying something, because Pro 2 is still not cheap. But like coming into Atlanta this year, it was so nice going into the round and knowing what the track was going to be like, and knowing what rear gear I had to have in the car, and knowing what tire pressures to set, and knowing what suspension changes to make, or like what to set the car up on at first, and like already knowing what to think of the track because I had driven it the year before. And that experience is something that's like unrivaled. And you can't, like, I couldn't expect to jump into Pro 1, much less afford to build a competitive car. Even if I had the competitive car, I couldn't expect myself to jump into Pro 1 and go like skunk one of these drivers that have been driving these tracks for 15 straight years with all their data and infinite knowledge on competitive drifting and how long they've been in it. And like, it's just something that I felt like I needed to sit back and kind of just keep learning at the level that I'm at and take my time to like gain the experience that I need in the competition world before I try to like make the next big jump.
Right. You watch both those guys make the jump to pro. Not looking for a critique or anything. Maybe had some time to watch a little bit for a couple of events already. What are your thoughts in kind of watching them kind of go through their paces and kind of start to get warmed into pro?
It's kind of a hard question.
Yeah.
Both those guys have more experience in competitive drifting than I do,
right,
by like a long shot. Like Kevin's been in pro, was in pro two for 4 years or something, like since the start of it. Right.
Is that right, Joey?
I know he was.
Yeah. So he was in
in pro two every year. Yeah.
Yeah. So from the start, so he like understands how competitive drifting works and he's like, for the most part, used to like the process. Van Kirk was in pro-am like 3 years before I came in. He had been driving for 3 years, including the year that I came in, which was 2016. So he had pro two competitive drifting or pro-am competitive drifting under his belt. And then he had his pro two license already during 2016 when I was in pro-am trying to get mine. And he actually ran two rounds that year while he was still competing in pro-am.
Oh, okay.
So he also had like an idea of what Pro 2 was going to be coming into last year because he had already done two rounds of it. I was still blind. I still like had no idea, especially with Pro-Am being my first year competing period. So going into Pro-Am rules and how they bracket drifting and then jumping to Pro 2 and everything being 100% different was already like a crazy difference and a real like aggressive learning curve. So, I mean, like, those guys have more experience than I did. So, at that point, it's, like, kind of personal preference and, like, living within your means and, like, what you can do and what you want to do.
Right.
My decision was just different, and I just decided to stay back because I felt like that would best benefit me and my team and my family and, honestly, like, my life in general. Yeah. 'Cause things would have been a lot crazier in the off season, if I would have chose to step up. And I think that if I would have tried to make it happen, it would have kind of hurt my view of competitive drifting as a whole. And then that's what I don't want to do. I don't want to change my mind state in drifting, and I don't want to change how I view it as a whole.
For people that are out there that may not really appreciate how different and how much more intensive the jump, you know, making the jump from pro two to pro is, give them like a little bit of an idea of how crazy that jump really is.
So you go from, and it all depends on how far out your pro-am series is too. 'Cause like some pro-am series, the cars are pretty simple. Some of them are like pretty crazy, but not even just in a sense of competition. Like it's basically like you're competing with the best pro-am drivers from the United States, right? In pro two. So, all you're competing against all the top guys in the series that you just finished. But even jumping into FD, there's so many different aspects other than the competition that come into play, the planning and the travel and the prep of the car and like the finances. And then on top of that, the judging system and how they run the events and like how you need to drive the car, how they want you to drive the car. And, I would compare it, I don't know, going from
like college basketball, like NCAA to the NBA kind of thing, right?
For me, yeah. So like as far as like eye-opening and how crazy of a difference it was, like imagine you're just like playing a pickup game like with your friends at some like crappy basketball court at like a middle school,
right?
And then jumping like straight into the NBA.
Right.
Like it's like I wasn't expecting for the jump to be so aggressive, but that's because so many different factors come into play that make it like that.
Yeah.
It may not look like that on like the live stream or like on people's like how they portray it on like social media or on the internet, but it's like, ask any Pro 2 driver that's fresh off the Pro-Am boat. Like, you are not expecting any part of what is happening. Like, right. It's crazy. It's nuts. I couldn't imagine nowadays going straight from Pro-Am to Pro 1. That would be absurd. Like, that'd be absolutely ridiculous.
Right. Well, and it's right. It's interesting because 5 years ago, there was no, well, right? 5 years ago, there was no Pro 2. Do I have the dates right?
2014 was the first Pro 2 season.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So,
which also Kevin Lawrence didn't run in. So Lawrence did 15, 16, and 17.
Okay. So it's three years.
And now 18 because he's doing both, right?
Right. Yeah.
He's got the skyline for, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's in his fourth year.
Do you think that at some point, if the opportunity was to arise, that you will make that jump from Pro 2 to Pro? You think that's something that you want to do?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the ultimate goal. I'm just like, I drift competitively because I love it and I want to like keep progressing and keep growing. Like how crazy would it be to like win a Pro 1 championship? Like, that's like the ultimate goal, right?
Right.
Well, while I'm still drifting, and I would say, like, I guess in my prime is like growing, like I'm still progressing, I'm still growing, and everything's good right now. So why not strive to like have that top goal eventually, you know?
Yeah. No.
As long as it's feasible, and as long as I can like put together a program with the right people and just make it happen comfortably. Cause I always told myself I wasn't going to jump in if everything wasn't like perfectly laid out and like set in stone, like months ahead of time. Like,
so smart.
I'd need like a spreadsheet, like lining out every small detail of the entire season before I'd make the jump, because I don't want to go into a Pro 1 season and not be 110% prepared for any situation that could happen.
Yeah. What do you think that for you to make the jump, if you, let's say Pro 2 ends tomorrow, you're done with that, you're given the opportunity to make the jump to Pro, you have the finances there, things are starting to align to put you in Pro, what changes do you think you have to make to the car, to your skill set, budget changes, program changes, prep to the car? What kind of things do you have to make different to be able to make that jump from Pro 2 to Pro successfully?
As far as I'm concerned, the entire program needs to be reworked 100%. The car needs to change 100%. I could not put a Pro 1 tire, like my tire size for my weight in Pro 1, I could not put that tire on my car and probably even spin the thing. The car needs a lot more power. It needs a lot more reliability. I need a lot more seat time. There's so many different things that need to be, they would have to be changed. Just because it's double the rounds, it's double the wear and tear on the vehicle. It's double the tire consumption, it's double the fuel consumption, it's double the travel. It's basically double everything plus some, because at that point of competition, you're pushing yourself so hard that you're bound to break parts. You're bound to run into issues and situations that you might not in like a smaller, like a shorter,
a shorter period year, of events. You know? Yeah.
Especially when the cars aren't as crazy and the competition's not like Pro 2 super competitive, but it's not as crazy as Pro 1, where these dudes are like dooring up so hard in top 32 that they're like crashing into each other and breaking stuff because they're trying that hard just to make it into top 16. Like, that's insane. Like, they have to, right now, like for Pro 1, you have to drive at 2010's like championship level driving. Right. Like, you have to drive at that level just to make it into top 16 nowadays. Yeah. Like, it's crazy. It's awesome that like the sport's progressing like that, but it is like, it's on another level. So
yeah, it's definitely come kind of a far way. I think Joe, you would agree with that we've made a pretty large leap and bounds. I mean, we've touched about it a little bit when we talk about the whole qualifying score difference from, you know, Tanner's days and stuff, and then coming up to where we are currently, but it's the whole sport has really just made a leaps and bound from, you know, from where we were years ago.
Yeah. I mean, 2010 was that's a long time ago in the,
okay. Maybe history. I'm still stuck in the early 2000s. We'll say like 2015, 2014.
Yeah. I mean, I think 2012 was a big shift in Formula D. I mean, if you look at Forsberg's 09 championship car, even Vaughn's 2010 championship car, they're pretty unimpressive by today's standards. I mean, they're probably about a Pro 2 build car.
Yeah, exactly. I'm only 25, though. I'm also, like, I still think that the 90s was, like, 10 years ago.
Fair enough.
I'm, like, I'm still, like, I'm stuck.
You know, I mean, I think the real, like, last, like, really subtle drift car to win Formula D was probably SS BMW in, what was that, 2013?
Yeah.
But, you know, after Daigo came in, like, that really pushed everybody into the higher horsepower, like chasing mechanical grip. And so, yeah, I mean, for sure, like, you look at some of these guys that won events back in the day, I think they would probably struggle in Pro 2 now, especially like having to be in like that same car and stuff of that nature.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So what specific changes do you think you'd end up having to make? Let's talk power for a second. What change do you think you end up making when you jump to Pro?
I'd probably need like minimum 750 at the tire would be like my absolute minimum.
Right.
And that'd probably be like the comfort zone as far as like how I like to drive cars. But yeah, that'd be like probably the bare minimum, like 750 as far as horsepower goes. And then at that point, you, since the power jumps so high and the torque numbers, like torque breaks things, horsepower doesn't. So especially since like I always like, I'm partial to V8s, torque's going to be a big thing. And like at that point you have to like budget in a lot more parts that could fail based on the power increase, like drivetrain parts and like other things that could break by jumping in horsepower that quickly. So,
just the amount of spare parts or the actual quality and type of part that you're using in the build.
I make sure like, I've always put like a quality part in my car.
Right.
So, cause I don't have the budget to have a lot of spares right now, even like there's some things that I really should have that I don't, just plain and simple. I just can't afford to have another one, you know, like not saying my parts in the car right now aren't quality. I just can't like afford to get more because I'd have to have a budget to buy more of what I already have.
Right.
But I've spent all of my money in the last few years to have what I have now. Yeah.
Right.
So I'd have to have like an excessive increase.
That's in crazy. Funding.
I'm not going to go into a Pro 1 series without a spare like motor, trans, and diff, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Or like a couple spare sets of axles, a couple. Basically, like you need to be competitive, you need an entire spare car minus the shell.
Right.
Like in Pro 1. Like you just have to have it to be prepared. Otherwise, like you'll come, eventually you'll break something that, I mean, Murphy's Law, you end up like breaking only what you don't have. So,
right.
You have to like cover your ass in a sense of like be prepared that way.
I'm trying to think. You laid out a lot of good stuff. Joe, do you have anything that you could think of?
Yeah, sure. You mentioned earlier Dylan Hughes was your favorite person to tandem with. Why Dylan, or like what's the relationship there?
So I met Dylan through friends, like through the grapevine, I guess. So like I worked at Nameless and John was running Chris's program for the first year. They were running Ryan's program and they would hang out with Chris's crew at the events when they were just running Ryan's program. And I was in Prime at the time and all the guys were hanging out in Canada in 2016. They were like, after the event, they were like at the bar, like getting food or whatever. And they were watching my live stream of Pro-Am and Dylan was like commenting and like messaging me, and I kind of met him through that because John was like, yo, I work with, or this kid works for me, he welds for me, and he's like running Pro-Am right now. And Dylan's like, oh, let me watch, because Dylan at the time was also in Pro-Am, just like on the other side of the country. So we were like at the same level. And then we met later that year at Seattle, like for the first time. And then Chris came on board, so we hung out more and more. He actually lived at my house for a few months while he was working for Nameless for like a few months during like Chris's program. So we knew each other like on a more personal level that way. And then we tried to drive as much as we could together. And our cars are like completely identical. It's the same exact motor, the same exact transmission, the same exact rear end, the same exact chassis. Our driving styles are exactly the same. All the steering and suspension stuff's identical. And we come from like almost an identical like driving background. So it's just really fun. It's almost like we almost feel like we're driving with ourselves, and it's like really easy to push that way and really easy to progress. So that's just why he's probably my favorite guy to like go jam with on the track.
Nice.
And we can trust each other. Trust is like the biggest thing in competitive drifting. At least you have to trust anyone that you're getting behind or getting in front of, you know?
That's got to be where that skill level does make a big difference too, right? You have some guys that probably are let's say they're coming up and they don't necessarily have what you would say all the skill level. They're kind of just getting into it. It makes that tandem a little dicey, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I made sure that as far as like drifting goes with tandem on a higher level, you kind of have to push yourself so hard to where you find yourself past that safe zone. Like you have to like bump into people. Like you have to like surpass the level of like safe zone in behind the wheel to where like you crash the car, you hit someone, you make mistakes. You have to like put up a, you have to figure out your wall. It's weird because it's such a difficult thing to do and such a difficult thing to grasp at first when you first start drifting.
Well, yeah, you have to find your edge where you know where you're, when you're pushing it and when you're right on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's a very fine line between being a very good chase run and being a very expensive chase run when you crash your stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
What's cool? I got a few questions that came in. I'm hoping I didn't miss any, but I got a couple of questions that came in from Instagram. One of the questions was from S197_Logan. He writes, he goes, what's your thought on the 255 tire rule for Pro 2 drivers?
I dig it. I feel bad for the guys whose cars in previous years are so heavy and they can't get the weight out of them.
Right.
But I do like what they're trying to do with it. And it's actually, it's working. Everyone like a set weight class, 2,900 pounds minimum with you in the car. And then everyone's limited to the same 255, 35 rear tire. So as long as the cars are all around that weight and at that tire size, it'll make it really competitive and it'll make it to where like you don't have, like there's no like Heilbruns anymore. They go into a Pro 2 year and like basically shut down points and guarantee a championship by like the third round because their car's like on a completely other level as far as competitiveness. It just, that doesn't really happen anymore. And I think that's what they're going for. And I dig it because it makes competition that much better and that much better for people to watch also.
I don't have too much else. Joey, you have anything else that you're thinking of?
No, I think we're good, man. I learned a lot. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. I hope that when people listen to this, first, I hope people listen to this, but I hope that when people, I hope that when people listen to this, the one takeaway that they, or the few takeaways they get are one about how reliable you need to make a vehicle and that you really need to build your skill level up to almost an unquestionable level, one for yourself and two for, you know, kind of the longevity of your program, right?
Mm-hmm.
And building in that reliable aspect of your vehicle is what will allow you to hit more events cost effectively is one aspect of it. But the other piece is that overbuilding your car is not a recipe for success. Learning your kind of your skill and your craft and really honing your skills before you start throwing power and parts at a car are an incredibly big piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have this conversation a lot when I'm at, like if I'm hanging out at like a local event, like Park or like Beard Peaks or like any of the, like the smaller tracks, like around me that are all grassroots, right. A lot of people like ask me like, when do you know to step up or like, what would you do in their situation? And I always tell people that seat time is the most important over anything. So right. Like when you go on with a crazy build to try to like build a competitive drift car, if you don't have the means to get it done in a timely manner, don't do it because you're missing out on so much valuable seat time that could build your skill level. And skill level is the most important, and like how comfortable you are in the car and how much time you have in the car. So I always tell people to like wait to like make that next change in the car unless they can get it done in a timely fashion to where they can get more seat time in that car with the new changes. Otherwise, right. Don't do it and keep driving what you have till you can afford to make the jump. And as same thing with like Pro-Am to Pro 2, anyone can like jump into Pro-Am. Like Evergreen has a grassroots competition that kind of prepares people for Pro-Am, which is really good. I didn't do that just because I had driven and tandemed with all my friends for a number of years already. I didn't feel like I needed to be there. So I jumped into Pro-Am, but looking back at it now, if I hadn't have done so well in Pro-Am, like even if, so I I podiumed 4 out of 5 events in Pro-Am. And then the only reason I didn't podium in the 5th event is because I did make a driver mistake, but I had a mechanical issue to where I had no power steering from the start of practice into competition, and I had never driven the car without power steering. So I did have a mechanical failure that hindered me from driving at a level that I felt comfortable with.
Right.
So essentially I made a mistake due to a mechanical and knocked myself out there. But I'll tell people like not to step up unless they can like confidently sweep the series that they're in.
Yeah, that's a really big piece.
If you can't go to Pro-Am and like shut down the series basically and like podium every single round, then
you're not ready to make the move.
Yeah, then you shouldn't jump, in my opinion. If I had maybe podiumed twice in Pro-Am and like got knocked out in like the top 16 or top 8 a couple times, and then a couple guys had broken and I had moved up in points due to luck or chance or something,
yeah,
I wouldn't have jumped. But competition in Pro-Am my year in 2016 at Evergreen was so tight and so crazy that I felt comfortable jumping just because of how high the competition level was. Because me and Matt Van Kirk in Pro-Am, it was like checkers or wreckers every time we'd meet, and we'd always meet like in a higher bracket, and we'd end up in like either battling for third or battling in the finals. I think we did 3 out of the 5 rounds we were in the finals battling each other, and almost every time it went one more time or two one more times before they could make a decision, because it was like checkers or wreckers at that point.
Right.
we were either gonna crash our cars into each other and go out with a mechanical, or we were gonna go one more time for the entire event, because that's like how tight it was and right. how comfortable we were with our cars. So it was like super fun. And I think that prepared me the most, like for the jump, having that experience in competition.
So Van Kirk was bro or arch nemesis?
Depended what part of the event it was.
Right. Yeah, I got that.
We were always homies until we were in the driver's seat. And then as soon as we got out of the driver's seats, we were homies again, no matter what happened.
I guess as it should be, right?
Yeah, right? Even to this day, like even if I line up with Dylan, which I really wanted to see him in the finals at Atlanta, that would have been absolutely sick. It would have been the same deal, like someone's car's getting pulled onto a trailer, or we're going to have to do battles on Saturday. Same with that, like I put my helmet on, line up next to Dylan, we give each other a thumbs up, and then we forget we're friends for like a minute and a half.
No, that's awesome. I'm going to give a shout out to Brendan Mayer. He gave 2 questions that we kind of already had answered, but he was cool enough to write some stuff. I don't know, man. I know Joey said he learned a lot. I definitely learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot about you, but the parts of that you bring for kind of the technical pieces for the skill levels and the Pro-Am, I'm not a drifter in that capacity at all, so there's no way I could ever really understand or know them without having been through them. So I appreciate you dishing that out. I hope people take that away and really learn something from that, especially if you're coming up, if you're a drifter that's looking to come up, or you're trying to kind of battle your way into Pro-Am or through Pro-Am right now, hope you take that away and kind of think about your program from a big vision area, and you know, really take what Travis said and how important it is to kind of build your skill set and make sure you have a reliable vehicle. And before you make jumps and put yourself in a different arena or area, make sure your skill level's on point. You know, don't play yourself by taking the what's rightfully deserved to you and then get in there and waste a whole bunch of time and money, because that's what we'll end up being. Seen that plenty.
You got to prepare so it's still fun when you're up there, you know?
Yeah.
So that you're not like chasing your tail or like getting yourself in a bind when it could have been avoided by just like being patient and taking some time. And I'll always help, like I'll be the first person to talk about this with a lot of like local guys that ask me.
Yeah.
Like I'll be the first person to like instantly reply to a DM based on these types of questions and be completely straight up, because I did it. And at first, like I was really nervous, like first making the jump, and it was like really scary, and I had to learn super fast. And a lot of aspects my first year, I wasn't prepared for, whether I liked it or not, but I really didn't have anybody to ask at that point. You know, I didn't really have someone to tell me what they would recommend to do or not to do.
Yeah.
So if someone comes up and asks me like what they should do, I'm going to be the first person to help them out and like give them pointers, because the last thing I want is for someone to like waste time or money like going into something unprepared when I could have helped prevent that, you know?
No, that's
cool. I'm just here to help drifters have more fun drifting and not feed to the internet thinking competitive drifting is the devil.
Listen, I appreciate that. I know we try to do as much, you know, it's one thing to be a company and try to make money, but there's, you know, we try to do a lot of things for the benefit of enthusiasts and the grassroots motorsports piece. Whether that translates or not, you know, I mean, I hope it does, but, you know, we really do it for the sake of the fact that most of the guys, you know, even if we're getting a little older now, we've all been motorsport guys and car enthusiasts. So in our way, it's kind of like, it's good to, one, still be involved in that arena, and two, be able to help because we can a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think that's it, man. I think we've taken up enough of your time and we're ready to move through. You have anything else you want to say?
Content? I'm off work. I'm relaxing. It's nice and sunny out here. I'm kicking it, you know? So, no, I mean, it's good to chat with you guys.
No, yeah, definitely.
Change of pace. I'm usually like in the shop jamming on something or like up helping Gramps do stuff. So this was kind of a change of pace.
That's awesome too. Cool. I think I love that even more about, you know, how tight you are with your grandfather, how important he is to your program.
Oh yeah. Him and my grandma are the rock for sure. They hold me down. And if I didn't have them in the start of Pro-Am, I wouldn't even be close to where I am today at all. I give them all that credit. They're the ones that pushed me. They're the ones that helped me when I needed help, or when I was making a decision that maybe wasn't beneficial, you know. Yeah. They'd like kind of like lay it down from their perspective with their infinite wisdom and knowledge and tell me that, don't make the mistake, we've done this before, so you should do it this way because we're going to save you a lot of headache.
Yeah.
And they're always right.
Yeah. And a grandfather was in aviation. That's pretty dope. I mean, my grandfather was a podiatrist, so while that was good for one end, it didn't really help me for cars.
Yeah, Gramps was a longshoreman. That was his trade, but he built airplanes. He built crazy jet boats, blown like big block boats and like all sorts of other hot rods and stuff. So he's been around the block as far as like anything cool and mechanical goes.
Yeah, that comes in handy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's nice because when I don't have a tool or don't have a weird little piece of hardware or something that I don't even know exists.
He does.
He always has it.
Yeah.
Always. I still, to this day, I go through his toolboxes and I pull things out that I'm like, what the hell? Like, I don't even know what this does. And he's like, oh, I made that tool in the early 90s to do this with this. Let me show you how it works. And I'm like, you're a maniac. Like, how do you even figure that out? Like, it's like mind blowing. If I could take away half his knowledge, like when he's gone, I'll be happy. Like, that dude is the best.
Yeah. Well, soak it in because everything goes pretty quick. That's for sure.
Yep.
Well, listen, I appreciate you doing this. Why don't you tell people where to find you on the old interweb there?
Oh, yeah. Just Travis Reeder, all lowercase, for Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat as well. That's just pretty much the main three things. I don't have a Twitter or YouTube channel or anything like that. I don't have time.
It's all good. Joey, why don't you tell them where to find you on Instagram?
It's just my name, Joey, and then Redmond, R-E-D-M-O-N-D.
Well, that's it for this one. For more info on the podcast, head over to koenigwheels.com/podcast. You can also catch us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at koenigwheelsusa. If you like what we're doing here, please take a few seconds, subscribe. We're on iTunes, Google Play, and you can catch the full video here on YouTube. That's it. We're out. Peace.
Bye, guys. Good chatting with you.